it's Nardwar, the human serviette, saying, you're listening to CJSF Burnaby and Doodoo-Loo-Doo CJSF.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, in the age of fascist plague, critical pedagogy challenges fascist aesthetics, and anti-Zionism. In defense of Gaza, small personal acts can be mighty. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Are you worried about the direction the world is heading today? Does the relentless rise of fascism, anti-immigrant hatred, and authoritarian tyranny scare you? Perhaps it's the ceaseless enrichment of a handful of already obscenely rich men, peddling climate-destroying AI technology, or the perfidious silence of corporate media, or the sterilization of public education systems that bum you out the most. If so, you may wish to resist. Before you get up, stand up, sit down, give Henri Giroux a read. No one captures the contours of fascist culture and aesthetics, the role of public education in resisting fascist plague, and the imperative to resist more sharply and colorfully and Henri Giroux. Henri Giroux is professor for scholarship in the public interest and Paulo Freire distinguished scholar in critical pedagogy at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Henri Giroux sat down with the GPM for a lengthy chat. Can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are.
Well, I'm a professor here at Mac. I've been here for about 24 years. I consider myself not just simply a scholar, but a public intellectual. I've been writing about a whole range of issues for a long time, and I think the world is in a perilous place, and I think that the work that we do is crucial to address it.
And you are here at McMaster. You're the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy. Who was Paulo Freire?
Paulo Freire was a revolutionary educator that came out of Brazil. In the 1960s, he organized a literacy campaign for which he became very famous. And once the junta took over, they put him in prison. And then he went into exile for about 20 years. But his work is utterly radical, revolutionary, liberatory. And he's basically an icon of critical education for progressives. He was very concerned about the relationship between what it meant to read the word and read the world. He's very concerned about how education became central to politics. He was a radical theologian. And he was he worked all over the world with dispossessed groups in order to give them a sense of what it meant to be both literate, address particular forms of oppression, and at the same time work collectively to resist it.
And his great work was Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
That was the Bible for him. But he did a lot of work. He had a lot of books. But that's the one I think most people know about.
What is critical pedagogy? What do we mean by that?
Critical pedagogy is basically an attempt to connect knowledge and values and skills to equip people in some way to be both informed and critically engaged citizens. It doesn't believe that education is simply about instrumentalism or operationalism or can be reduced to simply empiricism, that education is central to how a democracy functions. You don't have informed citizens, you don't have a democracy. And so there's an attempt in critical pedagogy to begin with the assumption that it's a project. It's a moral and political project. It attempts in some ways to provide the conditions for people to not only be reflective and to be engaged, but to learn how to take that knowledge and to use it to address important social issues. It's very unlike what Passus is teaching today. It's not a method at all. It's more of a way of enlightening people to come to grips with who they are, how they view themselves in the world, how they view others, and what it means to link questions of education to questions of justice and the fight for justice.
And he had this idea of teachers as students and students as teachers.
He had this idea that authority should be used in a way to give students the opportunity that they didn't have to be voiceless, that each could learn from each other. But there was a sense of authority in terms of putting together pedagogical practices that, for instance, affirmed who people are in terms of the histories that they brought to the educational experience. They weren't just clients. You know, they weren't just technicians. They were people who basically had an opportunity to engage in a dialogue with teachers that empowered them.
And here you've written a piece recently for Canadian Dimension entitled Critical Education in an Age of Authoritarianism, Why Educators Must Equip Young People to Read the World, Resist Oppression, and Defend Democracy. Democracy seems to be in peril, and educational systems seem to have a hard time, if I may generalize, kind of dealing with this situation.
Well, democracy is under siege. Fascism is rising all over the world. The number of governments in the world today that are basically democratic governments, I think, is reduced to 26. But I think that what's central to your question is the fact that education seems to be in the crosshairs of almost every fascist government in the world, or every rising authoritarian government, because they know that education is dangerous. When you get people who can think, then they have the possibility of holding power accountable. And for that, particularly now in the United States, as you well know, you see public education and higher education being censored, being bribed, being shut down. DEI programs are under attack. Professors who speak to important social issues are being fired. Tenure is being eliminated. Education for the right is not education. Education for the right is indoctrination. And it seems to me that universities have an enormous role to play in fighting back, and many of them are. They're succumbing. And increasingly, I think it's important to note that this should not be surprising, because since the 1970s, when higher education, maybe in some ways public education, sort of aligned themselves with democratic values. But after that, something happened. And what happened was they became corporations. What happened was the public education, higher education system became basically corporatized. They surrendered themselves to neoliberalism, to a kind of hyper-capitalist economy ruled by a financial elite, by monopolists, by people who basically thought that education should basically be used to train people.
And I remember studying here at McMaster University. I did my undergrad here from 71 to 75, and then my PhD from 76 to 81. And I remember when globalization, quote unquote, became kind of like the buzz phrase and the buzzword. And I remember the president of the university at the time, I don't recall the year, but I distinctly remember her talking about how McMaster University had to respond to this shift towards globalization, that McMaster University needed to become I'm not sure what the word is, but an instrument, a reflection of an agent of responding to globalization, whatever that means.
Well, I think that what it tends to mean in neoliberal terms is opening borders to trade. And allowing powerful countries to basically extract the resources from weaker countries, and establishing new modes of communication in which the rich and the powerful could communicate with each other faster, more efficiently, and in a way far more exploitively than they had in the past. But I don't think it meant that the university had to become more cosmopolitan. I don't think it meant that the university had to open its borders up in ways where it could be a driving force internationally for democratic values and democratic change. I don't think that happened. I think that the notion of the global was almost entirely captured by the notion of the economic, not by the notion of the democratic. You know, we weren't talking about democratic values. We were talking about economic values. We were talking about capital functioning in such a way that power was being separated from politics. Power was global. Politics was local. Power being global really controlled politics being local. For instance, I mean, during the great crisis of 2008, the international global organizations actually could take money out of people's accounts, as they did in Greece. and transfer those monies to increase the profits and the debt that the banks had suffered as a result of the financial crash. So I don't think that the globalization in that sense was a matter of innovation. I think it was a matter of adjustment. And I to the expanding financial markets, and I don't think the universities ever recovered in many ways. I think that increasingly they became more dependent upon outside sources. They became more dependent upon private funds, and increasingly the state, as it became more concentrated around neoliberal principles, underfunded universities. Universities were not seen as private institutions. They were seen as public institutions. And the public good all of a sudden became basically an object of scorn, you know, an object of derision, anything that was public and wasn't private, anything that didn't come under the direct control of the market, because the market became a template for everything. The only relationships that mattered were commercial relationships. The only subjects in the university that mattered were those that helped get people jobs. You know, nobody was talking about a kind of enlightenment that we saw in the 60s, where universities all of a sudden had to step back and ask themselves, in what way do they defend and enable democracy? And how does that replicate itself in terms of hiring practices? How does it replicate itself in terms of the organization of knowledge? How does it replicate itself in terms of the university having a mission where they speak to very important issues that in some way involve even the life of the planet, never mind major injustices? I think that what we've seen at Columbia, what we've seen at Harvard, what we've seen at Brown universities actually selling out now. You know, in dealing with a president in the United States who's like a mafioso leader. I mean, he basically threatens them by reducing funds for research. He tells them he wants to take over the governing structure. He wants to decide who gets hired and who doesn't. And to put it very, very succinctly, what he's concerned about is imposing on universities a white supremacist agenda. This basically is about white nationalism.
Let's talk about that. Let's get into this. It astonishes me as an American, I'm a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen, that for generations and generations, I mean since the founding of the United States throughout the 20th century, Americans went out and voted every 4 years, and they believed in their electoral system, I guess. They had faith in the electoral system. Americans, by and large, as best as I understand it, did not think that elections were systematically rigged. But Donald Trump has put this idea out, and now something like 78% of Republicans think that the 2020 elections were rigged. That's this huge proportion. Tens of millions of Americans think that when they go out to vote for senators and congressmen and for the president, it's rigged. Well, elections are corrupt.
Well, I think,
and I find this astonishing and scary. How is it that Donald Trump, simply by promulgating this idea, could have convinced so many Americans that they can no longer believe in the most fundamental basement foundation of American democracy? How's that possible?
Well, I don't think it's just Donald Trump. I don't think he alone. I think he certainly has an enormous insight into ways in which he can control a corporate media. But I think the real question here is, how does the culture produce a society that basically believes in lies? You know, what's at work in a culture that produces such an incredible level of civic illiteracy that even in the face of an election that was unquestionably won by somebody else, by Joe Biden, that they can be convinced that it wasn't won, that they can basically be convinced endlessly that everything that Donald Trump says and has some spirit of truth to it, when basically he's a pathological liar. And I think that what we have to look at the fact that, you know, what are the educational apparatuses that are making the formative cultures that are making this possible, that are stripping people of their ability to be critical, to be analytical, to be insightful? We can look to the schools and the universities that have failed in many ways. We can look to an economic situation in which people are basically struggling just to maintain their lifestyles, to be alive, to be able to buy medicine and get health care, and don't have the time to really be informed or access the institutions that can be that can inform them. And then we can look at the wider cultural apparatuses. I mean, five corporations control the media in the United States. Fox News, CBS now is being taken over by billionaires. I mean, what you have in the United States is a level of inequality at almost every level, political, economic, and social, that is the driving force to create what I would call a massive number of disimagination machines.
Disimagination.
They kill the imagination. They cut it off. They prevent people from thinking beyond the given. They prevent people from being able to think otherwise in order to act otherwise. And so people believe, A, we live in a democracy. They don't live in a democracy. The United States is not a democracy. The United States is controlled by big money. Everybody, I mean, how do you not know that? I mean, what does it take to run to be the president of the United States? What does it take to run to be a senator? It takes millions of dollars. It takes backers. It takes the support of lobbyists. This is a financial, it's a financial rig game. But at the same time, the lies are so overwhelming. The culture is so immersed in ignorance. The culture is produced by such massive disinformation machines that we are now suffering, particularly in the United States and in other countries, in Hungary, in Italy, certainly in Argentina. I mean, what we're seeing is a collapse of civic consciousness.
And language plays a huge role. These terms like Make America Great Again, MAGA Republicans, people talk about the MAGA movement, and I guess I would talk about the MAGA movement, but it's to use that term is to swallow and to incorporate this notion of making America great again. America used to be great. It isn't anymore. Well, or the big, beautiful bill. Trump talking about his big, beautiful bill. And in the media, they talk about the big, beautiful bill as this is actually something.
Well, they operate in empty catch terms that basically are nothing more than euphemisms for white supremacy. Make America great again really means make America white again.
But people don't question that language. The media doesn't question the language.
The corporate media doesn't. But it seems people are questioning it, of course. I mean, because what has happened with the Trump administration is that the promises that they make in the name of MAGA, which is a political movement, of course, which has taken over the Republican Party, have collapsed. And now all they have left is basically giving tax cuts to the billionaires and creating militarized armies that occupy cities and resort more to violence than they do to ideological justifications. So that's coming apart in some ways. But I think you're absolutely right. I think the power of these terms, and this is, I think, your point, and I think it's a good point, to go unquestioned in the major media. I mean, you didn't have two candidates running for the presidency in 24. You had a fascist running against somebody who was a liberal in 2024. But nobody names that, right? The press can't. It took so long for the press to even use the word fascism. Mm. Until people in his own cabinet who were leaving in the first instance, and this guy's a fascist, right? And for all the attributes that simply align it with ways in which we recognize another crisis, which is the crisis of history, the crisis of historical consciousness, you know, the crisis of being able to learn from history and to say, hey, look, you know, the big lie is not new, right? I mean, Hitler came to power on the big lie. Goebbels was a master at the big lie. Stephen Miller, the contemporary equivalent, of course, of Goebbels, knows exactly what he's doing with respect to producing.
And you've written this article. Here's another piece of yours. You're a very prolific essayist. This is something published in early January in Counterpunch. Goebbels' ghost and Miller's dream of a unified Reich. White House advisor Stephen Miller seems torn from the darkest archive of the 1930s. His ideological fever, spittle-laced tirades, compulsive lying, and theatrical rage are not excesses, but instruments, performative rituals through which cruelty is normalized and racism is taught. And kind of observing this guy, Stephen Miller, you know, I myself thought, I don't know where I got this idea from, that he's kind of like a Goebbels-like character, even looks like Joseph Goebbels a little bit.
Yeah, no, Goebbels. No, he does. And in a sense, he's part of something else that we haven't talked about. You know, I mean, he's part of a mega aesthetic. You know, this hyper-masculinity, this spitting when he talks. I mean, this rigid kind of body structure. I mean, Bovino, you know, who, of course, has now been shipped to, I don't know, the island, and the head of ICE, in some ways wearing clothes that really replicate something that he looks like he got out of Himmler's closet.
With a kind of a military-like uniform with a strap, a brown strap running diagonally across his chest, which is not a fashion feature that you see at all in the American military or the police establishment.
He looked like
a Gestapo chief.
I meant to say Goring's closet. It looks like it came out of Hermann Goring's closet. And then you look at that whole aesthetic. I mean, you know, the puffed up bodies. I mean, the square jaws, the plastic surgery, which is rampant among Republicans.
And you talk about a female fascist aesthetic and a male fascist aesthetic.
Yeah.
And on the female side, I mean, what really stands out for me is Kristi Noem.
Oh.
This image of Kristi Noem, you know, with her long brown hair pouring out of beneath a cowboy hat, standing in front of this jail, the Secok jail in El Salvador, with, you know, scores of bald, shaved men on their knees, tattooed. And she's using this as a backdrop, and she almost looks hot. This is kind of like a sexualized image of power and fascism in the feminized style with, you know, Botox lips and the female MAGA look.
No, it's a look that basically functions as fashion, which is a cover for cruelty. I mean, it's an aesthetic of cruelty. It's an aesthetic in which, you know, it rings of a kind of nostalgia, you know, pre-Disney, right? Long hair, lacquered hair, puffed up lips. And of course, on the other side, you know, the masculine image is the same. It speaks to a kind of standardization that takes on fashion, not in a sense of promoting joy and a kind of youthful aesthetic, or it takes on fashion as a way of covering over the cruelty that it reproduces and legitimates by translating it as entertainment and fashion. And it seems to me that that's a very important issue to address. Mega aesthetics is not something we should ignore, because people live in that world. And what they're saying to us is, we're going to write fascism on the culture of the body. The body now becomes a vehicle for, in some way, exhibiting this hyper sense of toxic masculinity. This kind of really, how do you say it? I mean, antiquated, really misogynist notion of women, you know, always in the background, overdressed, standardized, simply functioning as toys for powerful men. It's really the stepping stone into the world of Epstein and the world of fascist aesthetics.
And Caroline Leavitt, the chief spokesperson for the White House, looking, you know, this very attractive blonde woman, well-dressed, and this kind of appearance, this MAGA look, what's referred to as the Mar-a-Lago look. And she's always wearing this crucifix on her chest. Yeah. When she's standing there in front of the media, there's always this crucifix glistening on her chest, which kind of begs the question, if I were in that room, I would ask her, what would Jesus Christ think about what you are supporting and defending and putting out here?
Yeah. No, I think that for the MAGA aesthetic, everything is a cover, right? I mean, everything is a show. The cross symbolizing some sort of weak affinity with Christianity, as if that correlation exists at all, just the opposite of it, or a standardization of clothing that in some way speaks to appropriating high-end in ways that, instead of celebrating its, what could some would call its aesthetic beauty, becomes a cover for ugliness. a culture that's really ugly. You know, that as I say in one of my pieces, I start off, I say, it's a really ugly culture, you know, because it's steeped in violence, the legitimation of violence. It's steeped in racial hatred. It's a culture that basically tears families apart. It's a culture that rewards the rich. It's a culture that's destroying the environment. And it's done in a kind of third Gilded Age way. This is the third Gilded Age, right? And so it's an aesthetic that kind of matches the third Gilded Age. And it's horrendous, but it has a lot of currency. And it's imitated everywhere. And it's a step into, in a sense, not just appropriating a certain kind of reactionary fashion, it's a step into legitimating a particular kind of reactionary ideology. So that relationship between fashion and ideology, fashion and politics, becomes more clear when you're aware of what's going on here, right?
Does this worry you what's going on in the States? I'm sure it does.
Well, worry me. I mean, I think that this is one of the most severe crises that we've had in the United States since the Civil War. I mean, the United States is basically now been overtaken by a right-wing, white nationalist, white supremacist, fascist government. I mean, that's a crisis. Because we have no idea where this is going. I mean, I think there's enormous amounts of resistance that have emerged in light of what I call a state emerged in state terrorism. This is state terrorism. This is not politics. It's state terrorism. And, you know, there's just no telling how this is where this is going to go. You know, there are some people who believe, you know, it could be the end of the planet, given the fact that he just eliminated, as you know, yesterday, you know, all controls for environmental controls on the environment. I mean, how many people are going to die because of this? Children with asthma and illnesses and strokes. But this is a powerful machinery of death and exclusion. That's what it is. And it's rewriting the notion of citizenship, basically suggesting that anybody who's brown or not born in the United States cannot be a citizen, that citizenship is basically privilege for white Christian nationalists. And I think that what it's doing in terms of raising the level of politics for a state-sponsored form of racial cleansing is one of the most dangerous things I have seen in my lifetime. You know, I'm a great reader of people like Primo Levi, and others who came out of Hannah Arendt, and people who basically experienced fascism, although fascism had really begun with the Ku Klux Klan, didn't begin with Europe. And we know what the end point is here. We know what the end point is. The end point is the camps. The end point is first you kill the disabled, the people who basically don't fit into this notion of racial purity. You expel them. Then you put them in camps. You shut down dissent. You make a claim for racial cleansing. And there's only one place that can end up. And with ICE now being the most well-funded police force probably in the world, they're building prison camps everywhere. And you know, as my friend Tom Hartman says, they're not prison camps. They're really concentration camps. They're really concentration camps. I mean, prison camps suggest you have committed a crime and you were in prison for that crime. Concentration camps are there to dispose of people who are not considered racially and politically acceptable.
Henry Giroux is professor for scholarship in the public interest and Paulo Freire, distinguished scholar in critical pedagogy at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Among Henry Giroux's latest books, The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle, America at War with Itself, and, together with Brad Evans, Dangerous Thinking in the Age of the New Authoritarianism. We'll play the second half of our lengthy conversation with Henry Giroux in next week's edition of the GPM and post the complete interview at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the GPM. I am David Kattenberg. Then there's the Gaza genocide. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney won't use the G word. Keir Starmer, Frederick Mertz, Emmanuel Macron, and those other powerful Western leaders, well, they won't either. They want to help Israel out, militarily, economically, diplomatically, They want to be friends, not hold it accountable under international law. In startling contrast, those who do name Israeli crimes and call for justice, like Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in occupied Palestine, get hounded down. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has slapped crushing sanctions on Albanese and on the prosecutors